What's up, Bruce? What's going on?
Pete turned on the bot. Are you ready? Like,
wait, what? We're the Epic Experiment Podcast. That's right.
Oh, is that what we're doing tonight? Oh, okay.
I forgot.
Okay. I mean, I am old. I forget these things, but yeah. That's so right. I guess we are the Epic Experiment Podcast.
What are we talking about? Magic? Tricks?
I was gonna talk about snow and like ice and like the springtime coming, because like there's like no snow here. No.
Okay, old man. All right.
Well, anyway. Look, I spent my afternoon shaking my fist at the clouds. Like, come on, like it's not my fault.
It's all right. So, I'm running on like 4 hours of sleep, so we're gonna.
Yeah, me too. I know. You know, I know, because I was talking to you while you drove home, buddy. Good grief.
All right, so we're the Epic Experiment Podcast. This is what happens when you bring together an old man and a guy who thinks he's an old man. And you talk about a card game that we have no business playing because we're bad at the game. So if you don't like what you're hearing, hopefully you haven't turned us off by now. Our content is on the Lotus Council website, thelotuscouncil.com. And it's on various Discord servers and social media platforms. We're surprised we even know how to use social media at this point.
Bruce, some days.
How did we get a hold of us again?
I believe all the connections are in the social or down the show notes down below, so you can go and check at the bottom of the page wherever you find our lovely podcast.
There. So we're doing your favorite segment, right? We're doing garbage. Yeah, this is my favorite.
I like this one. This is good.
Are you ready for this card? Are you ready?
I'm ready. Oh, this card is. I've never seen this card before. What is this card?
This card is silly. All right.
Legitimately never seen this card.
It's called Modify Memory. Its art is really cool. It's four colors and a blue. It's a sorcery. So if it was an instant, it'd be, you know, perfect, but it's not.
Mm, man. Yeah.
This is what it says. All right. It's 12 cents, by the way. It says exchange control of two target creatures controlled by two different players. If you control neither creature, draw three cards.
Yeah, I mean, you said everything. Like, I like Switcheroo, but I don't play it because it doesn't feel like it gets me very far. But now that I can play God with my opponents and then draw cards, I'm in. I don't care about the rest of the card.
That's what blue does anyway, right? It just plays God.
Well, I just want to draw the cards. That's all I want to do. Is that so bad? Am I a bad person?
This is the most Simic. This is the most Simic card I've seen in my my existence.
Yeah, it's like Simic going crazy. Know.
Well, that, but also, like, it's Ancestral Recall, but it's also Switcheroo, right?
Well, you're right, because, like, Switcheroo is still a 5-mana sorcery, and now you're getting three cards tacked on for fun?
Worst case is you take someone's best creature and you give them, like, someone else's worst creature.
Yeah, that seems you know what I mean? To me. Yeah.
Like, you politic with your buddy, and you're like, hey, Joe, hey, I'm gonna give you this 1-mana 2/1, and I'm gonna get this 12/12 trample flying first strike haste thing that you put all the swords on for a turn or something. I don't know. Hopefully what's a better example? Blue.
Well, I mean, I'm gonna exchange your Atraxa for my sapling token.
Yeah.
That's to me you're doing some next level like Simic nonsense. And you're going to have a token of some sort of terrible little creature.
You know what's even meaner? You take their best creature and you play like Elish Norn, and then you give them a creature that's a 3/3, and then when they give it to them, it just dies. So they get nothing.
I'm pretty down with that. Like,
you know,
really,
like your 3/3 soldier is now a 1/1, and it just dies immediately, so they don't get anything. Right?
Yeah. Like, so I'm pretty. Like, all of this is like. Seems good to me. I'm in. And you get to draw me, and I get to draw some cards. Like, this is all music to my ears. So,
yeah. And then, the other caveat is like, you could literally just mess up both people's strategies too, right? You could, you could give someone like a spell slinging deck a really dangerous creature.
Yes.
And then you could give like the aggro deck one of their bad creatures that they're using as like a gutter snipe or something.
Yeah, you could do
just
can
be
do
chaotic, right? You could just have that chaotic energy and just be like, "Yeah, I'm gonna mess up this game."
Yes, you could literally just cause all sorts of havoc. I'm a big fan. I think this should be It is five mana, so you're not playing this in your CEDH deck. But if you're playing like a medium power level, this could be a good giggle. Everyone's going to get a laugh. I see no reason not to play this. If you're already playing a Switcheroo, and how many cards, like, I don't know how many cards are time of people play Switcheroo, but Switcheroo appears in some number of decks, I'm sure. EDH Rex says it appears in, that's Cube Cobra. That is the wrong link. I am not smart. Well, I'll try that again. This is good podcasting right here, Pete. All right, Switcheroo says it's in 3,000 decks. So if you're in 3,000 decks, and wow, look, it's playing like Zedru or John Arrhenicus or Cody. This seems like fun. I'm pretty in. I think this is funny.
And what do you have for us today?
All right, so I have Urgent Necropsy, which is a mythic from Murders at Carlisle Manor, which is, of course, my MO is usually I find the new cards. So two black and a green for an instant. As additional cost to cast a spell, collect evidence X, where X is the total mana value of permanence this spell targets. Destroy up to one artifact, up to one target creature, up to one target enchantment, and up to one target planeswalker. So it like pulls like a decimate sort of effect.
But it's not decimate. It's better. It's infinitely better. And I'll tell you why.
Okay, I'm sure you'll tell me.
Because I know you don't like this card, but I think it's
dog water, so.
I think it's good for the same reason you probably think it's bad, because you have to exile cards from your graveyard.
Yep.
And it's very limited in the sense that, like, if you do four mana value, you only get a two mana value things, or one 4 mana value thing or whatever for 4 mana. But I'm thinking about it as, like, I'm holding this card as long as possible. I'm trading off a bunch of things. And then I'm able to blow up, like, 4 things. Or 3 things most of the time, because not many people are playing Planeswalkers. But does it appear in enough decks to validate that it's bad? You know what I mean? If it's in probably, what, like, less than 1,000 decks, then maybe it's not very good.
It's in, like, 200, I think. I will have a quick little sneaky-poo look here. And it says it is in 291 decks.
Do you think this card could save your life, though, potentially?
I mean, there's no doubt it could. But I think, like, if your life total is under pressure and you're going to die to something, an Assassin's Trophy would do just as well.
Sure.
In almost every instance. Because everything that an Assassin's Trophy hits, this hits. And it costs 2 mana, and I don't have to exile anything from my yard. This fact I have to pay the cost of sacrificing stuff to get extra targets, to me, is, like, counterintuitive to the sort of deck that this wants to go in. Like, yeah, you're self-milling a bunch of stuff in there already, but that's with the hope that usually you're looking to get it back out and put it back to use for you. So I can really imagine this backfiring, like, where you're like, you have to react now because your opponent's got a thing that's going to knock you out. And you now have to exile that, you know, the troll or the big thing in your graveyard you want to get back out, so you can kill enough targets on the battlefield to save your bacon. So I think it's a really tricky cost, and it's not as intuitive as it might seem. It's not a catch-all the way an Assassin's Trophy is. And I think I'd probably lean into doing something else. If you're in this color combination, like, I'd probably start with something like a Culling Ritual for the same mana cost. It's going to kill a bunch of the same sorts of things, but also generate me a huge, like, influx of mana so I can advance my board state and make more impactful plays. So this, to me, feels like a card where, it could be a really awesome card in the right situation, but requires a high setup cost and a niche applicability to, like, make this be a card where you're saying you're really excited to play it.
I was going to give you a quick scenario. So, like, say you're playing Jund, playing, like, the Blitz guy, right? Henzi or whatever.
Yeah.
And you pitch a Meteor Golem with Faithless Looting.
Yeah.
Then you go to 4. Someone plays, like, a Rhystic Study or something dangerous. Someone else plays a 4-mana artifact, like a Lithiform Engine or something. That's, like, threatening. And then you play that card on 4. They exile the Meteor Golem from your graveyard because it does the same thing anyway. It costs 7. It's a 3/3. And then you just 2-for-1 them, right? So there's, okay. I think it's possible. I really think that it's underplayed because people haven't figured out how to break it yet. But I'm not. I feel like in three colors, it's better. Maybe Golgari, there's better potential other cards, but I like that it hits multiple things and you have four different options. But that's just me.
No, the options are good. I think I would probably play in this place Casualties of War. It's like what I would.
That makes sense too, because on the curve, I mean, yeah, it just depends, I guess, what your deck's trying to do.
Yeah,
because if you know if you're playing Sultai, maybe it might even work too, because you might be you might maybe you pitch like an enchantment you can't get back at that point, or like well, Abzan, I mean, or something. You know,
I think Abzan is more likely to have stuff where you can't recur certain things. I mm-hmm. think with Sultai, you probably got a Muldrotha list or something. You're gonna get
if
it
this
back
was
anyway.
Blue black. If this card was blue black, it would be infinitely better anyway, because you could just pitch an expensive instant or sorcery and do it that way. And I think that's how they tried to design this card, but they didn't really think about like the colors and how they react. So that actually jumps into our discussion today, right?
Yeah, it does.
We had this discussion about the color pie, and we revisited it. So this is how I look at Magic sort of right now. Like, there's this typical way that colors work and behave, and then there's these strengths and weaknesses attached to each color and what they were designed to do, right? For example, let's just keep it simple, right? So blue was designed to counters things, but also like play kind of like non-creature spells that were impactful, ideally, to close out a game, right? So the strength was back when it was you know earlier in this format and earlier in the game, blue was really good with like really good value cards and like really good ways to like mess up somebody's curve out, right? A counter spell. Mm-hmm. White was known for like weenies, right? It was just like going super, super wide pretty quickly, but had like a lack of ways sometimes to finish a game if the game went long. And then green was like big, fat things, dumb, thick things. And it would make tokens too with elves and stuff, but it was make bigger and badder, right? It was like bigger, but then it had the lack of like, until they cracked green, but they had the lack of like card advantage and the lack allegedly of removal, and then they just nerfed everything, so that's a different story.
Sounds a little bitter about some of it, but
I mean dude, come on. I mean Elder Gargaroth questing beast like really just housed everybody for a while. Card advantage with Toski, I love it, but I have a love-hate relationship with my friend the squirrel. So that, but red, right? Red is like used to be super aggressive, burn you out, super like finish the game quick. But then if the game went long, they couldn't do anything after like turn 5, ideally. And then black was all about leveraging like resources in a very sluggish way, but it could find any card in the game. So like it had the potential to survive and finish.
In a sluggish way, you say.
Yeah, dude, I'm not talking about Beseech the Mirror, all right? I'm talking about like the cards you grew up playing.
I grew up with Necro, dude. We grew up with Necropotence. We grew up with Yawgmoth's Will.
Anyway, so alright, fine. All right. Like, I'm just saying in a vacuum that black had this tendency to be slow, but could finish the game in an explosive fine. In an explosive way. Bruce.
Okay. I'm in. All right. I'll agree with that portion of it. It definitely can be explosive, for sure.
Whatever. It's all subjective anyway. But basically trying to say is each color has this undervalued sort of thing it does that we have now enough support to make it work.
Yeah.
So like, I'm going to just preview these, right? So when I was talking to you about this, we had like red has this really interesting way that it allows to copy things. It can copy creatures pretty well. It can copy spells and deflect spells, like deflecting SWAT, obviously, but like shunt, bolt bend. And then there's like some other niche cards like, you know, dual caster mage or flashing back instants and sorceries and stuff like that.
Right.
And then there's the clone aspect of it with like Jaxxus and Orithion and, you know, the ETB effects and sacrifice effects in red that would like clone things, right?
Right.
So that was like the like each one has its own secret sauce, right? So white was
for sure.
White for us was like secret, like the enchantress thing, and like the enchantments they have are good finishers. Black has political avenues. Blue has like this secret Voltron thing, and then green has storm. All right. So just to preview it real quick, what do you think of my idea so far, and where do we go?
So I like the conceptualization that there is a strategy or some sort of component to this, to the color, that is undermined, like undervalued by players. That there's some facet to the game that people have yet to tap into its fullest extent, and we are getting more and more support for some of these strategies all the time. And I think like it's a really interesting way of thinking about the colors, because I think when you look at things that typically we look at things in the terms of what the strengths they bring to the table. And what you're looking at is you're looking at a deficit that it is addressing, and you're using that deficit as a blind spot for your opponents. So people are playing red, they sit down, they're expecting you to play burn, or they're looking to play goblins, or looking to do something fast and very aggressive, and all of a sudden you come at them from the angle of making tokens and like duplicates of things, and they go, wait a second, I wasn't ready for this. And that blind spot is going to give you equity in terms of advancing your own game state and keeping them off balance, so you can, you know, try and win the game. Well, presumably. So I think that's a really interesting strategic choice that I think we should explore more thoroughly with our audience here.
Yeah, so that goes without saying that the colors themselves have gotten a lot more flexible with what they can do now, the potential for each color. But if you can recognize, as a disclaimer, that each color sort of inherently acts in this particular way, it'll, I think, be easier deck building. I think it'll be easier when you put the two colors together that you want, or three colors, to find a way to like exploit these hidden avenues in the sense of, because like my longest gripe for a while with red was like I thought that the removal was bad, but it wasn't the removal that's bad. It's the way we use these cards in their scenarios, right? We kind of two for one ourselves with like these chaos warp effects, right? And I still play them because I think they're equitable. But say like someone tries to path to exile your like combo piece, but then you shunt it and you exile their thing or somebody else's thing, you've changed the nature of that game, right?
True. You've changed, you definitely changed that initial exchange on resources there, where they're anticipating continuing to have their board.
Yeah.
And they are now not going to have maybe that key creature that they're looking to keep on their board, and that's going to really mess with their ability to, you know, think concretely about what's going next. And then on top of that, once you demonstrate the ability to turn things back in their face, people are more reticent to look at you and say, well, you're just playing red, you don't have counter magic. Well, no, actually I do.
I technically do, because I like fizzled your spell, or like I fizzled the target of what you were targeting.
Right.
Which is interesting. So anyway, I think going color by color will work. So we'll start with red, because we started with that at first.
Yeah.
So the cloning, Zada's very famous for this, obviously. Krark is the most known for copying instant sorceries with the flipping of the coins. Mm-hmm. But like, getting aggressive with red in the copying aspect might be beneficial. So like, Radiate is a very famous spell where it makes every single target copy. Or like, finishing a game with like Arcane Bombardment would be really neat. You know, because you're almost you're storming off, but then it's like you're also copying everything that you played beforehand, which I find interesting. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, no, for sure. I looked at Arcane Bombardment, and that was a card that I usually would look at this as being an effect that a blue-red deck would have access to. and would attribute that far more to the blue component of it than the red angle to it. And like the fact that you're looking at it from playing mono red to produce the effect. And I had to stop and think about it. I'm like, okay, like there are some cards that will do this. So things like Flame Shadow Conjuring or is an enchantment from, I believe it's Theros, Magic Origins. And whenever a non-token creature enters the battlefield under your control, you may pay red if you do create a token that's a copy. And then Determined Iteration is going to trigger. You're going to be able to make it, like, it's going to populate, so you get a second token of it. Now it stays. It doesn't just get sacked, which is, you know, kind of an interesting wrinkle to that, how it goes on, all that going on. What's the one that's a... Oh, the infinite combo piece, the flame. Oh, I'm gonna draw me
Flame Rush Rider.
Yeah, Flame Rush Rider is another one that can do the sort of.
You talking about Zealous Conscripts and Kiki?
No,
that's a pretty obvious one, right?
Well, like, it wasn't going that.
Not obvious.
I wasn't going there yet. That's.
I seriously, like Twin Flame with
Twin Flame
Caster Mage, but then there's like, Red has this low key like ETB sort of thing, right? It impacts like things entering the stack and entering the field.
Yes.
If that makes sense. You know what I mean?
No, it does, for sure. It's for sure.
Because, like, not something... Go ahead. The main thing that red does, right, that people play red, is the artifact synergy and then the burn, for the most part. Like, 95% of the decks, the commander decks that you see with red, is usually partnered with another color, and it's either a burn-related storm deck, where they're burning you out, or they're casting a bunch of things and playing Brain Freeze or whatever. You know what I mean? Or they're like a tokens deck or whatever, or like Gruul, like super aggressive. Like Xenagos is an ETB deck. Let's not kid ourselves.
Sure.
Right? So like when I think of ETBs, I think of white, or I think of like green. But red low-key has this weird stack interaction when things enter and when spells are cast on the stack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the overall thing, right? this is the overall thing that we got here.
The umbrella term of
this sort of idea, right? Mirror March is the other big one. I think that, I don't know if you had mentioned that. I'm sure you did.
Not yet, but we were going to get to Mirror March. I think Mirror March is one that's very, the other piece that you're getting to is that some of these things are very high variance. So Mirror March can be totally backbreaking, where it goes off and you get 5, 6, 7 copies if you win a bunch of flips in a row, or it could literally do, you know, one copy.
And same with these shunt like bolt bend effects, right? Like there are times where that card might just sit in your hand, or you pitch it early in the game because you think that you're going to get a little bit more aggressive than your opponents, and then you don't have any way to really protect your stuff.
Right.
I mean, red is still figuring out, I think, its identity as a color beyond the treasure production and the artifact synergies and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah.
And I think I'm curious to see what Wizards decides to do with it.
For sure.
The next color.
I was just going to say, coming back, definitely there's room for them to explore this angle some more to fully flush out this. If this is going to be a facet of what red can do, it's definitely got some work to do to flush it out more thoroughly.
We saw it in standard. I mean, with mono red burn, like mono red was like Godric and, you know, Charming Scoundrel, by the way, which is a $3 card. So I should have bought like 100 copies of that card, but that's my fault. Because I bought it when it was like 10 cents because people were like, this card sucks. And then they realized that it was good.
It's really good.
So ETBs, man. The next one is white, which we covered a little bit earlier as a preface, right? So to you, when you think of the color white, what do you think of really?
Well, I mean, my first thought when I think of white decks, I'm thinking about things where I'm going to, I'm either going to try and control the game by blowing up the board and setting my opponents back, or I'm looking to go very wide, very fast, and get aggressive after them. So your Cathar's Crusades and your Lord effects and things that are going to, anthems that are going to make my small creatures big and formidable, and we're going to attack and we're going to win.
Yeah.
That's what I think of white. And at least when I think of it on its own. Now, when I think of it in conjunction with a second color, my perception changes. But I think what you're getting at is that white doesn't need a second color to do the secret strategy that you're identifying.
Yes. So the Enchantress build, because I don't know why Wizards thinks green needs this. and like blue has a little bit of it, but like white is the OG Enchantress build, the OG way to build enchantment decks that have support. Yeah. So like all the aura card draws in white, except that green Cetezian Champion or whatever, that was a mistake printing, but.
I don't know about that. Like it's a very good card though.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is like Opalescence and like True Conviction and Cathartic Crusade, which you mentioned earlier, and Felidar Retreat, all these enchantments sort of finish the game for white in a way where like they were going wide and then trying to finish the game that way.
Well, I think the row of like the murderer's row of white enchantments is really quite daunting, because you, like you mentioned, Cathar's Crusade, Felidar Retreat, Opalescence, Sigil of the Empty Throne, and then you get into things like Divine Visitation, Anointed Procession, Court of Grace, Hallowed Haunting. Like these are like, this is a murderer's row of who's who of white enchantments, and yeah, they're all expensive, and you're playing in a color combination that is going to be hard pressed to ramp there. But you're also in a color combination that can control the board better than most other colors. So you could buy yourself the time to get there to resolve these things and then turn the game on its ear as you make tokens. But when you cast things and build a wide and very powerful board state very quickly and beat your opponent in the dust.
Yeah. So like, I don't know if Wizards did this originally because of like the Paladin thing with enchantments and like, or if it was just because white had that access point in the game, like all the circles, like the circle of protection stuff and that sort of thing. But like we were thinking, you know, Catilda would be a perfect commander for this strategy. I think
Catilda would be awesome with this.
I mean, Halvar is obvious, like really good for auras and stuff, because it gives double strike, and then there's Zenik, which is like the Universe of Beyond card that gives everything exalted. All your auras become exalted. It's a crazy finisher, by the way. I've blown people out with that card many times. But we were looking at it when Bruce and I sort of reevaluated this idea. Looking at it is like, we're making enchantment tokens, or we're making creatures that we could put things auras on and make them bigger and smack you for a ton of damage. And Catilda was like the obvious sort of choice for this Enchantress like payoff, because you need the payoffs to finish the game, in this sense. So, yeah, I mean, I like the way that white is going with its catch-up mechanics too. But, what are you excited? Do you think they're gonna keep doing this route? Do you think they're gonna move away from this stuff?
I think they're gonna keep leaning into this, into the powerful enchantments. I think you know, we've seen in some of the new products coming out that there's
like Andu Spirit Dancer copies enchantments when they enter.
Yeah. And then and you get powerful enchantment removal. So you get your ossifications and whatnot. So I think they're going to keep leaning into this. I don't think this is something, a facet of white's identity that's going to melt away into and other
a
preface stuff.
Too is like white enchantments used to just lock things down, simply put. Right. And now it's like they're doing more with it. And we also mentioned, I love that you mentioned that we've had this evolution of white where like blue white used to be like the auras build, right?
Yeah.
And now it's becoming white green. But we love blue white for that because it was so cool to see it pop off like in 60 card. Like I have a friend who plays a heroic deck still, and he loves that deck. So. Yeah, cool. All right. The next thing we got is one of my favorite ideas. So black, you know, it's all about death and sacrifice. But I think it's a political avenue, man. What do you think? I think well, I've spread, I, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, you've definitely been like very strongly a strong proponent of the political component to black. I've always looked at black as being political in the sense, though, but I'm making a choice to sacrifice my resources to advance my game, whether it's my life totals or my creatures or my artifacts or sacrificing something already, some resource I have to advance myself in some other direction. And a great example of that would be Necropotence, which Necro is a, you know, is a classic example of me deciding I'm going to trade my life points for cards. And in some situations, it works out beautifully. In other situations, it burns you and you end up losing the game because you've flown a little close to the sun. And that was only the political choice that I was thinking about black. But I think what you've gotten to here is a very different interpretation of how that politics manifests at the table.
Yeah, so for me, black was like one of those colors that you can secretly tempo your opponents through the idea that, like, no matter what they do, you still get the value you want. So, like, Necrotic Hexes, each player sacrifices six creatures. You make six tap 2/2 zombies, right? Everybody has to do it. Everyone goes through it, but they go through it worse than you do, right? Oppression, everyone discards a card, but, like, you can get creatures back, or you don't care what you're discarding because you have payoffs, like Bone Miser or something.
Yes.
Or, like, Painful Quandary gives that other... It's just your opponents only get the choice. And it's still political, though, because they get to decide what they want to do. Some people will take the five life easy, or some people just discard a card because they don't care. The other consideration is, like, Tormenta Hailfire. Exsanguinate isn't really a political card, but the finisher that you were stating, Gary... It's almost like you trap your opponents into making these bad choices so that way they can't interact once you do finish the game.
That's, I think you phrased it really well.
Is that where you were trying to go for? Because I remember...
Well, yes. When we were talking about this, like, I look at this, at the political choices you're presenting for your opponents as being, and I like the way you treat it, as trap them. You trap them in a situation where there's no good option, and consequently, you're softening them up so that you're putting them in striking distance of your powerful finishers. So it could be as simple as a Green Merchant of Azvidel. It could be a Torment of Hellfire. It could be an Exsanguinate. It could be a Bolas of Citadel, and you're going to do some silly shenanigans off the top of your deck. But you softened up your opponents, and I really liked, like, the choice of the commander that sort of exemplifies what you're getting at. Is like Braid's Recurring Nightmare. Is it Braid's Recurring Nightmare? No, it's Arisen Nightmare. Braid's Arisen Nightmare presents your opponents with a choice, and none of them is good choices. They have to make a choice. They either take damage or they're going to give you cards, and both are good for you. They can only give you so many cards before they're like, this is unsustainable, because now Pete's going to just go ham and destroy me. So they have to start taking the loss of life, and that every time they take a loss of life, they're going to be putting themselves that much closer to being susceptible to the Grey Merchant, or they can't pay the life to the Painful Quandary and have to sacrifice something, or
the other thing,
on and on and on.
Yeah. So, like, Dread Summons, Breach the Multiverse, Rise of the Dark Realms, those cards to me are also political engines because they trap your opponents. The new the Shouldred, Flip Shouldred too.
Yes.
Each play, and there's a ton of cards that do that in black. Each opponent discards a card or sacks a creature, right? Each opponent sacrifices a creature with the biggest power they control. Each opponent does this particular thing that's supposed to mitigate the harm that does to you. So that's where I look at it. And I like the way that black does this because I think it's very fair, where there are other colors that make it unfair. Right.
No, I fully agree. And I think when we talked about it initially, I was less excited for the concept that you were presenting. But then when you put it and turn it around and like, no, the black is making your opponents make choices. And I'm like, it doesn't seem like a big leap of like from cognitive point position from like where I was at, where I'm sacrificing my stuff to advance my board state. But I think the way you phrase it, to trap your opponents into making bad choices, is a really like excellent way of describing what is going on here and why this is a strategy that is, you know, compelling, but also powerful.
Thank you. Okay, so blue, right? Blue is very, very well known for control, but in a sense of fair control. And it loves artifacts. So the secret sort of strategy we were talking about is blue is excellent for Voltron. It's actually going to be super strong. I came off of, actually, this idea came off of a friend of mine who plays a Popper EDH deck, a PDH deck, where he runs Invisible Stalker as his commander. And then he smacks you for a ton of damage with it. And he put down, hit me once, and he put me down by like 20 life points just from one hit.
Yeah. So for starters, the PTSD for Invisible Stalker is strong. That and Slitherblade. Those two cards have caused me endless amounts of grief in limited formats. But yeah, so this sort of strategy, and I think this is a really interesting approach where one of the attributes that blue cards have is that they're unblockable. Like there's in every set, there's probably something that's unblockable. So an Invisible Stalker or a Slitherblade or there's a Merfolk from River... Oh, what's from Ixalan?
River like Guide a 1/1 something? Yeah. It gets +1/+1 when a Merfolk enters or whatever. There's River, a Baldur's Gate one as well. There's a Baldur's Gate one that says it's like a 0/3 and it gets +2/+0 if you control a Merfolk or something and it's unblockable or something like that. Yeah, so
there's Gadul Lurker too. It's like all these things can't be blocked. They're small creatures, can't be blocked, and these are the perfect sorts of targets to slap some equipment on, and now you're going to not just have creatures that like your opponents are unable to interact with them on the board state, so now they're going to have to dedicate removal spells from their hands or board wipes to aggressively deal with your board, and
you can bounce it back to your hand or whatever, or like you can you can negate that, you know what I mean? So it provides that protection package that Voltron lacks usually.
For its
cost. And you can recur artifacts in blue, which is cool, from the graveyard.
Yeah, very, very easily at that, too. So, you know, an Emery or a few other simple things is going to get you, I believe Temeshi, well, Temeshi's blue-white, but anyway. But like, so Emery is, like, a great one. You can get all sorts of things back and get your swords back and whatnot. And then the swords provide you with protection. So even if you have a creature that doesn't have evasion of its own naturally, the swords of X and Y, you can put them on stuff, and now somebody at the table is in big trouble. And I have to say, the Kamigawa Neon Dynasty gave us the reconfigure mechanic, which I think is one of those ones that like we haven't thoroughly processed just how effective that can be as a tool. Because I think like the commander you sort of highlighted as being emblematic of this sort of strategy, the reality chip, is like that's a banger right there. That's a great, not only is that a great target because you can, it plays right into that equipment theme, but it also has such a powerful draw engine attached to it that you're going to, you know, outvalue your opponents very quickly if reality chip sticks on the table equipped to something like an Invisible Stalker.
Yeah, and it's sneaky, right? It's a sneaky very way much to do so. It.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is a very underappreciated approach or strategy. Because I don't think I've ever heard anybody say, I play Mono Blue Voltron. Have you ever heard those words come out of somebody's mouth?
There's only one person I know that did a Voltron sort of esque deck, but it wasn't what you... Like, it didn't play the swords. It was just an artifact value deck at that point.
Right.
So it didn't strictly like come out as like, I want to hit you in the face as hard as I can.
Yeah, but I think somebody would be well within... Like, I think someone would have a very good strategic idea to play Mono Blue Voltron and dome you in the face for a million damage.
Like, you could use Urza as like a ramp, and you could flash in like a grafted exoskeleton onto like something and kill somebody that way, which would be hilarious.
Oh my god!
Right,
grafted exoskeleton.
Because you tap all your equipment, and then you just like psh, like it's like it's like Power Rangers or whatever, where they would come together and morph into this big stompy robot smackadoo. Anyway, Mech Titan would be funny to run there.
I was thinking cranial plating too, but unfortunately, it's got a black activation. Too bad.
That's all right. But blue also has those tutors, so you don't really care. Like you can run War of Invention. You can run.
Oh, I forgot about that card. Yes,
you can run that. You can run the improvise other other improvised targets. Forge the Anchor is actually low key decent. It's 3 mana. Look at like 5 cards or 10 cards or something.
Yeah.
And then there's obviously the OG Fabricate. That's like a no brainer there. Mm-hmm. And if you're rich, you can run Transmute Artifact, but that's a different story. So anyway, proxy that one, folks.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
the last one I was hating on earlier as a joke, but green. Okay, green is like, I'm going to smack you in the face with a dinosaur or like, you know, a freaking dragon or something. Like some big, dumb creature that smacks you in the face for a bunch of damage. Or a beast.
Old Gnawbone.
Yeah. So we've seen this in CDH, Bruce, with mono green with Marwyn. The storm potential of green because of all the tools it has as a color now.
Yeah.
But when we saw Aive is like an ooze that gets copied for the amount of times that you cast spells before you cast it. But the less obvious one that we wanted to discuss was one of the coolest cards they've printed in recent years, in my opinion.
Yeah, this card is Yadora. Brand new out of the Carlo Banner Commander set. Yadora Grave Gardener. This thing is cool. What does this do?
So Yadora says, it's 4 colors and a green, legendary creature, treefolk, 5/5. Whenever another non-token creature control dies, you may return to the battlefield face down under its owner's control, and it's a forest. So it was actually printed in Commander 2021, and then they reprinted it a few times in some of these alternate arts and stuff. The storm potential is like, because green is really, really, really good at hitting your land drops consistently, creating payoffs if you sacrifice lands or ETB lands.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I could imagine you're playing Tireless Provisioner. You're playing 3 lands a turn with Azusa or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, like, your creature dies. It comes back as a forest. It ETBs. It causes a trigger. And then you have, like, 8 mana. You get to play another spell. And you just keep looping spells until you get to where you want to be.
So. I think this leads itself into like a big mana loops where your creatures, and I think the key component there I'm thinking is like you want to be in control of your creatures dying. So you're looking to control what dies and what doesn't. So things like Greater Good and Ashna's Altar and Phyrexian Altar and Altar of Dementia, like things that are free sac outlets, and then like using those, the movement of cards from creature to forest, tap the forest, sack the forest to an orb, float the mana, casting things like Splendid Reclamation, getting all the forests back out of your graveyard or you know, other ways to get creatures back out of your graveyard into your hand and recast them again. You're going to storm off pretty hard, and it doesn't take a whole lot of brains to figure out that an Aetherflux Reservoir is a great tool in this sort of deck. Because, and I feel like there's a lot of green decks, and I would usually have associated this with Simic, but now like this is like Yadora leans into like it looks like a Simic effect, but on a mono green card, and you're going to be able to storm out her pretty hard, I think, and. It won't be long before you're in Aetherflux Reservoir is ready to dome your opponents for 50. So
this one is, of the best cards that I noticed as well is the Sylvan Safekeeper, you know?
Yes. Yes.
So
Sylvan Safekeeper is an excellent card.
I was looking at, there's 64 cards right now that you can sack a land to do an effect. So, like, mm-hmm. Constant Mist is one.
Forgot about that one.
There's just a lot of, like, interesting just, like, plays you could do, right? Like mm-hmm. Perilous Forays with Yadora just seems silly, right? Pay 1 sack a creature, search your library for a land with a basic land type, put it into play tapped, right? Or primal growth, you're ramping out, you're cleaning up all the lands in your play, and then when your creatures die, they'd be like, you could play that with what's her face, the elemental that makes everything a forest anyway,
Ashaya
a Shaya, right? So it's like your creature, yeah. You tap your creature as a forest, then you sacrifice it. Then it comes back, turned over as a forest.
Yep.
Then you tap that and sacrifice that, and then it comes, it doesn't come back, but no, it there's definitely a way to do it.
Yeah. And then Titania, Titania, Protector of Argoth, is going to reward you for all that movement of things around various states, from creature to forest, from forest to back to your graveyard, to be looped again, and Titania is just going to sit there and accrue stupid amounts of value for you. So, or your Avenger of Zendikar, or whatever else. Like, in Storm, it's going to feel like you've just gone and popped off something ferocious.
Yeah, so there's some really weird combos. Like, Den Protector with Eudora and Ashnod's Altar makes it so that you just keep flipping up Den Protector and then sacrificing it.
Yeah.
Because you keep returning cards from your grid. You know what I mean? And there's like, I just searched it. I searched Eudora on this Commander Spellbook website, and there's almost 170 results for this. So what? There's definitely people doing some crazy, interesting things with it.
And it costs 17 cents.
Yeah. And it's in a bunch of decks. Like, a bunch of people are running these weird combos in some of their decks. Like, Living Lands, Blasting Station, and Eudora. Because it's infinite damage.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, like, people are doing some stupidly weird things. And, like, I'm here for it because that's something you don't see every single day.
I remember Living Lands as a kid, and it was such a terrible card. And now Eudora makes it good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is like, people, I don't think anybody ever thinks about a green in this capacity. And it can absolutely go and do this. And this looks to me of all the colors that we looked at, is the most exciting. I guess it's something I want to actively try and do. I have, to this point in my Magic playing career, largely avoided monocolored commander decks.
Because of the fact that it feels restricting, right? Like, if you're going to play monocolored, you could just draft that. Or you could, play like a 60 card, you know, mono white or mono red or whatever list.
Yes.
That just smacks people in this current meta. I mean, I'm sure mono green and blue and black were really disgusting. And black is still pretty good.
Yeah,
they're all pretty good, actually. What am I saying? They're all pretty good right now. But
yeah.
I guess I lean more towards it because I still don't have any money, but like, I didn't have a lot of money to spend on Magic cards, right? So I started with the monocolored stuff and then slowly worked my way into the multicolored shenanigans.
Right.
But consistency, I mean, if we're looking at anything, it's like these colors are very consistent in the fact that they're able to do these weird things together. And they have the support for it now.
Yeah, for sure. They have the support, and the support makes it, and the support's affordable. It's not like you're talking about super expensive cards. So you can get into these strategies. The mana's reliable because you're playing like basics for the most part. Mm-hmm. Maybe a few utility lands. Like, it's just a really good way of like getting, again, capitalizing on a blind spot and keeping your budget under control. So I think it's actually a really, really cagey strategy to look at these deficits as strengths of the colors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also when I evaluate color, like cards with certain requirements, usually when I determine if a card is playable for this particular deck, it's like, does it support the overall theme of the deck? But then, does it actually support what the color tries to do most of the time, right? Like, what's its tendency? What's the tendency of these colors to interact the way that they do?
Right.
When I combine them together, unless it's like a super like specific thing, like Auras in Orzhov, you know, it's pretty easy for me to see like, okay, these are the cards that I want to play for this particular deck. But then there are times where it doesn't work out because, you know, the game is too, there's too much variance, and the cards, you don't know if they're actually going to react the way you want them to sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
Either.
It's interesting. It's an interesting way of looking at things, and it's a good conversation to explore as a thought exercise. And so, yeah, like, I mean, audience, if you have got other ideas or for these some of these sort of hidden strategies or less prevalent strategies, like, let us know. We'd love to have that conversation with you guys. These are just, you know, our thoughts on the colors and the color pie, because I think there's a lot of interesting space to explore, both from a gameplay and a deck design standpoint. So I think there's a lot of interesting things set still there. Anyway, Pete, is there anything else that we wanted to share before we sign off for the night?
Yeah, colorless's secret strategy is colorless is nothing.
No, colorless is far from nothing. Colorless is like, I think it depends on whether you're talking about artifacts or you're playing Eldrazi.
Let's say colorless, but it's like, it's more of the artifact sort of thing, because I feel like Eldrazi, there's not enough support.
With the Zul'Dok deck that came out, and then the new five-colored Eldrazi deck coming with Modern Horizons 3, I think Eldrazis are going to be well poised to just run amok, and we'll be up to our neck in Eldrazi spawn token soon. But I think with the artifacts, I think artifacts are suitably broad, and that oftentimes decks play artifacts because the artifacts lean into deficits that they don't have already, meaning they can literally cover all five colors off.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's a strategy in artifacts that is more prevalent than others, because there's artifact decks of all flavors, whether ranging from aggressive takes where they're playing modular cards to cards that are playing you're playing tangle wires with stupid amounts of counters on them because you proliferated a lot because you're a bad person. These are all the whole gamut of the spectrum. And so I don't think there's any one thing that colors can do or not do any better than anything else. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but that's how I view colors.
Yeah, I think that there's potential. I really want them to do a deck, a colorless deck that doesn't lean into either. If they can do something that would sort of make the colorless idea, I think they are not. I think they're concerned that if they really pull the trigger on this,
yes, because
you know.
The problem with artifacts,
it breaks the mana restriction, right? So that's the problem. Well, it does that.
It breaks mana restrictions. It busts the color pie because now you're now introducing effects that can be played by all five colors. It's the same effect as like why Phyrexian mana is so problematic, because now you can literally have originally Phyrexian mana was such a problem because you could now put Dismember in any deck. Free.
Yeah,
it's free. And same thing with artifacts. The reason Kaladesh was so problematic, you could put Looter Scooter in anything. You could put these powerful equipment or vehicles or just other artifacts in every build, and cause so much damage to the game. So they're very nervous about what they do with colorless. That I think colorless, we're never going to see colorless be really given the tools to go truly off, because of the fact that if it does, then we break a bunch of formats.
Yeah. It'd be cool if they did something weird with, like, instead of drawing a card or something with a colorless, like, creature, you, like, say you attacked with colorless creatures, and you got to grab cards from the bottom of your deck, like that, you know?
Something kind of silly like that.
Kind of like Grenzo, but it was like you would draw them or maybe exile them from the bottom. And if that'd they don't cool. get played or something like that. So, because I know like the Void used to be a pretty big deal, obviously for the fact that like the stack would interact with it. But not to digress too much, but I think overall the color pie is changing, and I think we should be more keen about what is happening. Mm-hmm. If this is any lesson for for the game. It's like,
yeah,
the colors are really interacting in unique ways now that we haven't seen, or they're changing them, like the colors interaction with each other. So,
yeah, no, absolutely. I think games in flux, and as we try and explore power, like the power as available to the game, and they keep having to try and sell more cards, power creep and bleed across colors into and pushing the color pie outwards into new spaces, I think is inevitable. And it's resulting in some really decks that I think 5 years ago would not have existed even slightly.
Yep. All right. That's a wrap. Thanks, everybody.
There's a wrap? Where's a wrap? I'm hungry.
Oh. I was...
Oh, you... Oh.
Like, right. Like, oh, maybe like the ending hip-hop. It, I was thinking...
I wanted like a sandwich. Like a good, like wrap.
Like a Reuben or something?
Yeah, like a Reuben wrap. That'd be so good. But I got... Oh, I'm sorry. I digress. We're trying to end the show. Sorry. I'll go have a sandwich in a moment.
All our brain power just went out the window. Did we even have any to begin with? Nobody knows.
Who knows? They stuck with us this long. They're probably ready for a sandwich, too.
All right. Take care, everyone. See you next week.
Thanks, everybody. Be good, everyone. Take care. We'll talk to you soon. Bye, everybody.